Hey everybody, welcome back. This is Joe from Archery World.
Henry from Archery World as well.
And today we're going to interview Brian Fry, the owner of Radical Archery Design. He is a premier maker of peep sights for bowstrings, and he has also got a broadhead company in under the Rad Archery line too. That is a really awesome set of broadheads and a ton of choices. So welcome to the program, Brian.
Hey. It's good to see you.
Yeah. So, hey, let's go ahead and get started, buddy. I've known Brian for, I guess it's been the better part of since I've had my shop for going on 22 years. But I think I really got to know you probably about 15 years ago. You own Rad Archery Designs, and the biggest thing that you started out with on that was your peeps. But before you started that, let's talk about your history in the archery community. So how did you start out and how did you end up where you're at right now?
Well, I've been in the hunting and fishing industry since I was 11, working on the docks and fishing industry. And that sort of led to guiding some people that were in the archery industry. And that led to being the sales rep and then grew up from there.
Well, so let's give a little bit. So that history, since you were 11, I suppose that puts you at, 40 plus years in the industry then? I'm not trying to pin down your age or anything, but you're older than me, so I can make fun of you a little bit.
Yeah, it's about 40 years.
Yeah. You got, when you started into the archery side of things, you know, after you started guiding, you said, and you had a pro shop up in the Seattle area, didn't you?
Yeah, Wood Creek Archery out of Woodinville.
All right. And how long did you have that?
Oh, gosh. I think we had that for 3 years before my accident. And then it was sort of a accumulation of things, me not being able to work and my partner, Greg Sage, going through a divorce. We decided to close that up. But that was a pretty good time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, I talked to you about that, you know, when I was pretty young in our business too, and used some of your business models and stuff that helped me. Now you said you had an accident. You might explain, if you want to, what happened. You know, didn't you hurt your back pretty good, didn't you?
That was actually later. The big accident that caused all the problems was actually while bear baiting, and back when we could bear bait, we were running baits behind a gate with motorcycles, and I had a 5 gallon bucket full of bait come loose in some loose gravel. And I don't really remember much of the accident other than branches hit my hands and waking up wondering where I was down in the brush. So,
oh wow.
So I did a lot of neck damage and took me quite some time to recover from that.
Well, I know we've went out, you know, pheasant and chucker hunting, and I know you talked to me about it then years ago, and it still affects you today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. A lot of thought and concentration type of things. There's some CTE effects from that, as well as a few other things that have happened to my head over the years, but I guess that's what happens when you play hard.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, that being said, you know, you said it has affected some of your, you know, things, but your decisions have been sound in what you're doing now for sure. You know, with Rad Archery, it's pretty much the only peep that we carry. I mean, we carry a couple that have some interchangeable apertures, but as far as like the meat and potatoes of the hunting industry, and then even some target style peeps, you dominate for us because the quality's so good, and then the peep is a good quality. And it, you would think it doesn't take to make a lot. You know, the average person would think it doesn't take much to make a good peep, but it does. So when you started your manufacturing of peeps, we'll go into the process in that in a minute, but what made you decide peeps is where it's at? And then in your kind of moving forward a little bit, how about broadheads? What made you think, hey, I think I could make this industry better, this part of the industry better?
Yeah, well, I had Worked in manufacturing of archery equipment for quite a few years with Archer's Ammo. Ended up being their sales manager. And when I left, I had been watching the archery industry pretty close to find something that, the fast development or fast changes in the industry had sort of forgotten. And peep sights ended up being the one that really jumped out. I remember watching a movie, I believe it was a Daredevil movie, where they were shooting a bow and the tubing was in the way of the sight and nothing lined up with the shooter's eyes. And I realized that as we've gone shorter and shorter in axle to axle length in bows, the peeps had not made that transition along with the bows. So that was an item that I decided to focus on, and we our original item was called a true aligner that aligns a aluminum angled peep with your eye with the tubing, and we had an agreement with Fletcher's to supply the peeps, and then at the last moment Fletcher's pulled out, and so we ended up having all of our cards, all of our business plan. I had quit my job working for Maurice Sporting Goods, and all of a sudden we were not going to be able to go forward. So we decided we'd go full-fledged into peeps and redesign the Fletcher style peep to be more string friendly and more durable and have the correct angles. So that's sort of how that got started. Then
Well, and I guess the timing, sorry about that. I suppose the timing was pretty good too, because as these new parallel limbos were, the time frame you're talking about is kind of when parallel limbos came on the market, and it started to require different angles for different axle lengths to begin with. So your timing was pretty good, even if it was forced by necessity at the time. So that's a pretty neat thing.
Yeah, it was really a blessing in disguise having that pulled out from underneath of us, because we were able to then concentrate a little bit more on the specifics of what we were looking at industry-wise. And then we combined that with sort of some modern marketing. Peep sights back then were on clip strips or in a little plastic bag, and there were no UPC codes for the shops. So the technology and the point of sale for archery shops was being ignored at the same time. So concentrating on that, along with a peep that worked better for today's shorter, faster bows, was definitely in a need. So it ended up being perfect timing.
Yeah, it was. And then with your background in different pro shops and owning your own shop, you knew the need that the shop owners would want from the start, which is a plus too. So that's kind of neat. Instead of now meeting the request that another manufacturer was wanting from you, you not only met those and then kind of got hung out on them, you started designing your own, seeing what you could improve on the industry. So that's a pretty cool story on how you got to where you're at now. So how, of course, this is a question that we're going to get to ask almost everybody that we interview this year. How has COVID affected your business, and how did you adjust your business model for it? Because everybody I know that manufactures or that is in business has had to adjust their business model to some degree, and it's forced us, kind of like you were talking about before, it's forced all of us to reevaluate some things and make some and streamline some processes that make things more proficient to begin with. So, how's that affected you?
We haven't been affected too much by COVID since we are a home-based business. We haven't had to run into a lot of the COVID issues. Archery is still seen, sales have still seemed to be pretty good. We're doing a little bit more to people that focused on mail order rather than just strictly pro shop. But our biggest adjustment has been in the delay for our supply chain. Even things as simple as aluminum now, which used to take 2 days to receive is, we're 30 days out, that type of thing. So changing our schedule on how and when we order and build ends up being an adjustment that we weren't quite expecting.
Yeah, well, and as a business owner that buys from you the finished product, we've noticed that too. So in your case, you're talking about a 15 time delay. And then Bose, it's the same thing. When a foundry shuts down and it was a cast riser or aluminum products weren't sitting on deck at the factory, the delay is immense, because you and the archery industry becomes kind of like, not to say it in a bad way, but bottom of the line. So I've always kind of been thinking of it this way, and I've heard people that run skyscrapers and things like that, if they're sending a million pounds of material to a skyscraper, do they really want to take your order for 200 pounds of aluminum that you need for your job to keep your industry going when they can barely get it themselves? So we kind of fall in the food chain where we fall, and it's slowly recovering, but it's made us all adjust to that to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. Even trickling all the way down to freight. It used to take us 3 days to get an order to California once we pick it. We're seeing up to 10 days just to get from Vancouver, Washington to California by the normal means. So it seems top to bottom, there seems to be delay issues that affects the business. But as far as business is concerned, it's actually been very good. A lot of more people are staying home and shooting.
That's good. And so the nice thing for us is, as we've adjusted, we've seen that delay too, whether it's shipping or materials or whatever. So customers for us, on the bottom line, since we're the customer-based business, they have made really adjustments themselves for our business. And I guess it's a necessity. And the nice thing about the archery community is more people understand that than the I want it right now. And of course, there's always going to be that, but we appreciate all those customers that understand that some things are just out of our control that have this the trickle effect that we've all experienced.
Yeah, I think that shops that don't understand or don't supply a real service are struggling right now. Ones that just want to have people walk in the door, grab product, and walk out seem to be struggling. But shops that have a full service center are making strings and tying in peep sights, giving shooting instruction, that type of thing. The full service shop seems to be doing pretty well.
Yeah. Well, and then that's kind of hopefully what keeps all the pro shops out and around and keeps the industry moving and forward. Especially if you love archery, you don't want to see it die off because of lack of planning on anyone's side. So we're gonna jump into the process now. Henry's got a bunch of questions for you on that, and I know you're to kind of segue into this. You're one of probably the most comprehensive thinkers I know. I know you said that you've got that motorcycle wreck caused some neck problems and thinking problems and so on, but it has never stopped you from overthinking things, which is a blessing in our industry when you can get products made in a way that overthinks what everyone else has done. It usually puts you in a category that stands out. So, Henry, ask hit him up with your questions.
Yeah, so when you go into like designing a peep or a broadhead, what do you kind of go into as far as designing those?
Well, it's completely different approaches on the two. With a peep sight, we're really focusing on clarity and being kind to the strings. And there's not a whole lot of designing out what we don't want while we're trying to design what we want into a product. In broadheads, it's very important to in not only design what you want into a product, but you have to design what you don't want out of the product. And in that respect, it's very different. And then with broadheads, there's a lot of research and knowledge developed in the medical clinical portion, the metallurgical portion, and then manufacturing. So it ends up being a much more deliberate process in designing a broadhead than it is peep sight.
Right. What and like when you're machining them and stuff like that, what kind of tooling goes into the whole building process?
It reasonably simple for the base product, which ends up being on Swiss screw machines and turning centers, and that is for both the broadhead ferrules and the peep sights. The real trick ends up being getting it to a point where the peep sights are string friendly, and that the broadheads are true to the various inserts that are out there. So the right. ammo standards for pluses and minuses on inserts and on ferrules is pretty wide. So if you end up having a manufacturer that's building to the extreme of a plus side of a insert, and we're going the exact to the extreme minus on the parallel section of a RPS point, you end up having a lot of issues. So you concentrate on making sure that you sort of find that happy medium, but at the same time that all of your edges have to be completely flush and parallel to make sure that a broadhead will spin properly.
Right. And so for people that don't know what the ammo specs are, you'd mentioned that. I know what it is based, you know, because I worked at Gold Tip and dealt with a little bit of the manufacturing stuff. But can you go in and explain that? Like, you're talking about runouts and inserts and stuff like that. And you're right. Companies have that widespread because if they tighten it up, now you got a $10 per arrow insert instead of a 50 cent per arrow insert, right? So
yeah, that's a large portion of it. The other thing is we have to make sure that since they're being manufactured across a wide array of vendors, that parts will come actually assemble. So they ended up making it as wide as possible. So there's a manufacturing window or a tolerance window that allows, say, the guy that's building the inserts in Florida to match with the field points or the broadheads from the guys in Washington State. So it ends up being pretty important. They tried to get them as tight as they could to make sure that everybody would be able to get their broadheads to spin properly, or the field points would actually screw in. But they're tight enough to where you can usually find ways of making it work. So we use around here, we'll get some inserts in that are just horrible. You know, customers will say, I just can't get broadheads to spin properly, and send theirs to us. So we always have them send the insert or an arrow with them, and try and figure out what the problems are. And so often we use plumber's tape in the threads. When you have things that are extreme, a couple wraps with plumber's tape, and all of a sudden everything, all the problems are solved.
Right. Have you found one manufacturer to be on the lower side of that than others when you're dealing with this, you know, like repeat customers sending product and saying that, hey, you know, my broadheads just aren't flying right, or they're not spinning correct, and you have them send your arrow.
Yeah, it's usually in spinning, and the variance in the inserts ends up being almost 90% of the problems that we run into. If you're running right. Saunders or you're running Easton, you usually don't seem to have any issues at all. But you get some of these imported inserts from somebody you've never heard of, and they're all over the board.
Right. And so one thing is we've kind of got a big customer base kind of swinging towards this, and we're trying to educate people. And I know you probably get asked this a lot, but like with the FOC thing, do you foresee yourself coming out with some heavier grain broadheads in the 150s plus, just to kind of combat some of this, or, you know, kind of what's your thoughts on this whole FOC train that's going on?
I think FOC is pretty important for guys out west. I'm not sure that it ends up being that important when you're shooting out of a tree stand and 30 yards is the longest shot you take. But I always try and convince people to be 12% or further. The FOC, dynamic FOC, constantly changes in the flight of the arrow. So you can have a say you decide you're going to have a 10% FOC. As the broadhead hits a thermal or a fletching hits a raindrop or you have a crosswind, that virtual FOC slides back and forth constantly. And so you need to make sure that your FOC is enough to overcome when that slides back. And so, and with broadheads, that ends up being much more important than field points. So I usually always tell people if you can be at 12 to 15%, you're going to avoid those problems without going excessive on your FOC.
And what a lot of people don't understand is they think that an arrow doesn't flex through flight, right? And so everybody bases everything off of static FOC. Well, then you got your arrow flexing, which when it flexes, it shortens its overall length, right? And then that changes your percentage of FOC too. Now, it's probably very minimal, right? Kind of like a raindrop or something like that, but it still, comes into effect and things like that.
Yeah, there's multiple variations that cause it to change, and so you just have to put a little bit more out there. I think if more people shot 125 grain heads, you'd probably see a lot less flight issues with people. Everybody used to want speed, wanted speed, wanted speed. Now everybody wants long range accuracy, and the FOC does change that. The extreme FOC that you're seeing today, it almost causes as much problems as it solves. But if you're in that, that sweet spot for a compound bow between 12 and 15% and between 15 and 20% for a traditional, you'd really take advantage of both things.
And I think a lot of these guys that are going towards this extreme side don't see the negatives. They just want us in the shop to fix their negatives, which a lot of times, as you know, arrow spine's important, right? And a lot of these guys are already running 70 pounds, 29 to 30 inches. They're full on in a 300 spine, almost borderline 250 as it is. And then they're adding, an extra 100 grains to their insert and then wonder why their stuff don't tune because their arrow's so weak, and then, so I'm sure you kind of probably see that when guys talk to you about like this extreme FOC stuff, you get up to like that kind of I'd say extreme would be 15 plus, right? For a compound, 15 is probably about maximum. If you're an 18, you're not too far away, but if you're targeting like that 20 to 27, and I've even heard of guys trying to hit 30%, now it's just kind of like opening up a whole can of worms as far as tunability and, pretty much the shootability of the bow, because now you got so much weight in that arrow that your pin gap's atrocious
Yeah, I
too.
think there's been a lot of traction given to the, there's a dentist that has written quite a bit of information out there that, really centered, most of his papers centered on using a longbow for dangerous game in Africa. And the arrow weights are extreme that you're dealing there with. The longbow is so sensitive to spine that you end up playing a lot of different games to try and get to what you need in that situation. But we're hunting whitetails, and elk is a big animal for us here in the States, and a lot of that's just not needed, and it's not seen.
No, it's a lot of overkill. And I know you're talking about you're bringing up the Dr. Ashby stuff, which, is all fine and dandy for traditional style shooting, but now you got these guys that are going on this traditional kick with their compound and they're kind of getting away from the whole efficiencies of even using a compound because, you know, that guy goes extreme and he'll run even up to like a 800-900 grain arrow, right? And he'll have just this atrocious amount of FOC. But, you know, I'm seeing a swing in guys that want to hit 500 plus grain arrows, you know, out of their compound. And, you know, they just don't want to deal with the backlash. And you know, I think that's kind of, you know, kind of along.
Yeah,
the
I
same
think there's
lines,
a little bit
know?
Of social pressure that's been coming along with it. Guys really get into that, and you're
absolutely
starting to see that, you know, oh, I have to shoot high FOC because, you know, everybody's going to talk down to me or not accept the way I'm shooting. And not realizing that,
right.
You know, putting the arrow in the right spot is what matters the most. If your broadhead's designed properly, you're going to do fine with this, the animals we're shooting here. We're not shooting hippos or rhinos or elephants. We're shooting North American big game, and it's accuracy is the name of the game.
Right. It's almost like social bullying on your hunting setup, right? Like if you're not shooting the new norm of 27% FOC, you're not ethically hunting, and people will call you out on the internet about it. And it's like, you know, it's just all it is just drinking the Kool-Aid, and there's no education tort against it right now, which is crazy because people have been hunting that same way for the last 20 plus years, right? Since carbon arrow started coming out. And now you've got all these people going towards this extreme and high FOC setups because of something that a doctor wrote pertaining to.
Yeah, it's a, you know, there's a sort of an odd perception out there that you know, if you can have the heaviest weight bow or the heaviest FOC out there, that somehow you're going to have all of these benefits and none of these negatives. And with a compound bow, in almost all archery, it seems like there's always a happy medium or a balance there. And there's some rules that you need to follow. You need to follow the FOC rule to an extent. You have to have fletching that's matched the size of head that you have. But when in regards to penetration, a lot of these guys are doing the FOC because they think it's going to improve penetration. You have to realize that it's a friction issue. So if we could eliminate friction altogether, we could shoot through trees at 100 feet per second. So often we ignore what causes the friction. We end up shooting expandable broadheads. We want 2 inches wide cutting surfaces and think that our FOC is going to make up for that. And so in broadhead design, we try and make sure that, you know, we're helping people, you know, the woman that's shooting 40 pounds or the kid that's shooting 50 pounds or the guy that's shooting 80 pounds are all going to have good penetration.
Right. Yeah, no, it, you know, that's the thing is, you know, and like you said, that's the other thing is there's no real education on like the actual setups, right? I mean, as far as, you know, we try our best in the shops, but, you know, people that come in are internet pros and, you know, some of them know better than the people that they ask questions to and things like that. And, you know, they don't put a whole lot of thought into the veins or this or that to get their flight correct. They just assume that by going to this 150 grain broadhead, it's going to solve all their problems. But a lot of these guys don't understand that putting more time on the range and putting more time behind their system so that they can make a better shot is really what they need. Not this holy grail of a 650 grain arrow with 27% FOC that's just like a magic cure-all pill.
It's sort of a danger that happens there when we get so centrally focused on the hot new thing that we forget what it is that actually effectively and humanely kills animals. And so all of a sudden we forget that, you know, our broadheads have to be sharp. We forget that we have to have the right angles, not only for penetration, but to slice what we need as the broadhead cuts. And if you don't have
Right.
a, you take like the Howard Hill broadhead, which has killed plenty of animals throughout the years. A lot of people are copying that these days, but they're copying it with a real soft steel that's easy to work with. By the time you get through the hair, the hide, and the chest wall of an elk, you've lost 50% of the edge of those heads. And if you don't have the right grind angles or a little bit steeper cut, you're having a harder time cutting, the blood vessels and the larger holes in the lungs that you really need to have to put an animal down quick. And so we forget it what actually kills because we're so concentrated in that FOC number. And you're really seeing it,
Right.
even in manufacturing, you're seeing guys that, have completely for manufacturers that have completely forgot that you need to have a hard, sharp blade to actually cut what you need to cut once you're inside of the chest cavity.
Right. And then we'll kind of get off the FOC train because we can talk, you could talk about that for 20 years and talk till you're blue in the face, and you're not going to get past these guys that are reading these books and watching these YouTube sensations tell everybody that that's what they need. So back to your business, what do you have new coming out for 2021?
As far as new products are concerned, we have a small game point that is designed for the guy that doesn't want to spend a lot of money but would like to get out there and shoot more. We've actually designed a ferrule that
Okay.
allows a standard off the shelf from your hardware store quarter 20 T-nut to be attached to the arrow. We have a rad team of shooters from across the country in Australia that we contacted and say, how many of you guys are roving and stump shooting and getting out there and doing that? And there was surprisingly few people that were doing it. And we, when we asked why, everybody said it's too expensive and they're always too difficult to clean. They skip, they do all these things. So I set into a sort of a frenzy of buying every single small game head that I could find on the market. My wife and I, we'd go up in the hills and just go shooting, and it was just extremely frustrating. And we wouldn't take some shots. That's a $9 small game head. We don't want to take that, that risky shot through the branches and stuff. We're going to lose it. So we really set out to try and find something that was not only effective, reduce skipping off hard surfaces, didn't get buried into half the time you think it's a rotten stump and it's not a rotten stump. And then when it does fail, when we shoot a rock that we thought was a piece of wood or a clump of dirt, you don't have to throw the whole thing away. You just go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy some more T-nuts and off you go. So it's a pretty exciting product that works far better than we ever expected it to. And hits a price point that just about everybody can get out there and have fun roving.
Right. Yeah, that sounds like that should be a pretty good, mover, especially like we've got a lot of guys that buy small game heads and stuff like that. So that should work out pretty good for us in the shop as well. And then what kind of guarantee do you guys have on your guys' products? Just for the people that don't kind of
Well,
know.
we work with the shops real heavily, and we'll pretty much accept anything back that a shop deems has failed. So we don't have a
Right.
printed lifetime warranty or anything, but it's just good business to always take care of people. Even unhappy customers take care of them and bring products back or swap out products for them. We have a lot of guys that get
Right.
our biggest head is a inch and 3/16 four blade, and some people just can't get that to fly well. And they'll call us up and say, I spent I spent $40 on these, and is there any way that I can make them work? And we always just say, just send them back. We'll send you something that'll work better for your setup. And so we try and make sure that it stays flexible, but at the same time, we like them to go to archery shops where they can get the proper instruction to make those right decisions. Because me trying to make their decision over the phone is usually not nearly as good as getting into a pro shop and actually talking with the people that can put hands on the product and see what their issues may be.
Exactly. Well, and we appreciate that too, especially as a shop owner, because you've always taken care of anything that we've got going on. But like you described, you know, if somebody gets the wrong broadhead for their setup, but they don't know it, sometimes they find out because they're running a really tiny fletch and they're going with a big bladed broadhead that's four blades on top of it, because they think bigger is better, more cut, more kill, you know, and it's got to get there first. They forget that sometimes. You've always taken care of anything that we've had, and that's another reason. I'll kind of tell you my personal experiences. I've killed, I don't know the amount of, because I don't, it's not like I'm a animal slayer or anything, but I do like to kind of keep track of what broadhead I'm using when I hunt. And I know I've killed at least a couple of elk and three or four deer with your broadhead specifically. And going on to that train, I particularly like your titanium broadheads. And for titanium, they're probably the least expensive titanium on the market that you'll find, especially at the quality they are. So I like the Van Dyke, which is named after a really close friend of yours that's a professional hunter. And I like that broadhead because it's a low profile blade system and it's only got a 1-inch cut. But again, shot placement is everything on that. So if you shoot them in the wrong spot, nothing works. If you shoot them in the right spot, almost everything works. But and you touched on a lot of points that we really need to touch on again is a sharp blade and a hard blade, something that's going to stay sharp after it goes through that wall cavity. And that titanium tip is just remarkable on how many times you can practice with it and then change your blades over to your hunting for that one time shot to a fresh set of blades. And it's remarkable how sharp that tip on that titanium broadhead
Yeah,
space.
they you know, which we try and keep this our entire line to where, you know, the average archer can use it, even when we get into the titanium. And by not using, you know, by building everything in-house and not using secondary people for multiple things, we're able to keep a lot of that down without having to go to China where or Asia, where so many people are having products built now. Sort of the odd thing in tying those two things together is that we have a gentleman named Justin Lannis, who is, you know, probably one of the best hunters that we know, who lives in Hawaii. I think he just shot his third world record ram over there, and so he has the top three spots for open range rams, and he does a lot of testing for us. New products, existing products, any change that we make, always get it out to him, and he's very good at not only telling us exactly where he hit and what he hit, but the distance traveled after hit. And that's really the thing that we try and concentrate on, is, you know, distance traveled. We would really like nobody to ever have to blood trail because they watch all their animals go down. That's sort of the ultimate goal. And we watched very
Well,
closely
that
when he started shooting the 1-inch heads and the 3/16 heads together. And everybody thinks, well, the 3/16 has got to kill faster than the 1-inch. And what we found is it's exactly the opposite. The blade, there's a threshold there where you go from a primarily slicing head in the 1-inch to a primarily chopping head in the 3/16, just because of a ever so small change in blade angles. And the 1-inch routinely kills animals in a shorter distance. There's a lot of different factors that go in there, shock, impact, penetration, and that type of thing. But just because it's a smaller diameter head does not necessarily mean that it's a less effective head. Now, if you want blood on the ground, say you're very poor at blood trailing, or somebody who's colorblind, that type of thing, the larger cut definitely puts more blood on the ground. But as far as the speed of kill, that we have seen, and I've watched this over the last 30 years, does not seem to be any correlation between the diameter of cut and the distance traveled.
Well, that is what I experience when I use that 1-inch head, because my shot placement is that much more accurate because I get more close to field point flight. But then I love hearing or seeing the animal drop. So I'll tell you, from using your broadheads, my longest animal traveled, I lost sight of, which is, usually you hear them dump or you see them tip over, but it was a doe I shot on the last day of season. I'd killed an elk a couple of days before, and I was in Idaho, and I'd had a deer tag, so I didn't want to go home without anything. So I saw this doe on the last day, and I shot her, and she went 80 yards, and I was crazy surprised when I found her that she went that far, because usually my experience has been 40 to 60 yards when you double lung something. If they can't breathe, they can't run. So they're really just running off adrenaline for that last little bit. And since they can run 20 miles in the woods, or 20 miles an hour, or 30 miles an hour in the woods, they can go a pretty long ways on that last breath. But that last breath is typically 40 yards. And she went 80 yards. So I was kind of astonished that she went that far. And then it was just, I think, pure adrenaline. But dumping multiple animals under 100 yards is pretty nice. And that's all been done with that 1-inch blade cut. So that's really what I've liked. Now, I tend to shoot towards the mid lungs. I don't try to include a heart shot as much as I should, because of either having to guess distance or whatever factor makes me think, all right, if I'm going to miss, I can miss 3 inches or 4 inches higher, the same blow if I aim at the middle of the lungs. And when you shoot higher in the lungs, you don't get as much external blood because there's not as many vessels up there. But the lung cavity fills up, and the chest cavity fills up so dramatically, they smother so fast that it's a typical easy recovery. So that's what I've found. If I incorporated more heart shots, I'm sure I'd get more blood on the outside, but it's just not in my DNA, I guess. I just want to shoot that weakest part of the ribs
Yeah, I have
recover
one
fast.
elk that you and I have spoken about in the past, that if I had chose to go double lung, I'd killed a couple different times. So the same bull that I hit in the shoulder
Right.
3 years in a row, finally somebody else got it by shooting him center lung. But I always got so close, and the shot was so perfect that I just got a little too full of myself. I'm just going to put it right through the center of the heart, and he move a little bit, or I wasn't watching my bubble, and boom, you're just so close to the shoulders on a big old elk. No poundage, no arrow is going to get you to drive through the ball joint. So.
Right. Well, bullets can't do it, so getting the arrow to do it doesn't really matter what you're
Yep.
shooting most of the time. Well, I appreciate the consistency in your product and in the delivery and performance that it's always provided for us. We recommend your stuff to everybody, not because I know you, but because it's good, and it just makes it that much easier when I know you as well. So we'll always, stand by that too. And when we, so the PEEPs, the broadhead line are huge for us, because they're just solid products. So, to wrap it up though, Brian, if you can think now, you're gonna have to put on your thinking cap for a second. You might already know this answer right off the top of your head, but where do you see yourself in the next, in 5 years? What
Well,
do you want to be doing?
I had been thinking about that quite a bit, we'd just like to continue selling broadheads and peeps, and maybe expand the line a little bit. As far as retiring, that I'm starting to get close to that age, but A lot of it's going to revolve around what happens with crossbows in the Northwest. Our particular section of the market is being negatively affected heavily by the mass amount of crossbows out there. And so, if we can get vertical bows to start bouncing back throughout the Midwest, and we can stop putting them in archery seasons in the out west, then we'll hopefully continue doing what we're doing and enjoying the process.
Yeah, well, and I hear what you're saying about that. So the nice thing about west of the Rockies is you don't see as many opportunities to use a crossbow during archery season because there's less game. It's not as prolific. Whitetail are more prolific in on the East Coast, where there's more opportunity to take and bag more during the season. So the hunters had pushed for the crossbow season there during general archery season, and eventually most of the East Coast has allowed that, which has affected what you're calling your vertical bow sales, which is your normal bows, compound bows. So you don't obviously put a peep in a crossbow. Now, there's for us, you can hunt in Washington in cross. You can use a crossbow during archery season if you have a handicap permit and you went through the process of getting that registered through the state of or through Olympia, and you can use it during modern firearm season as a downgraded weapon, and use it during modern firearm season. In Oregon, it's still not legal at all, and even for handicap hunters. So I know there's a push to do that, but I don't think, and I hope that we don't push that so that crossbows can be used during a general season unless you're handicapped. I agree during that type of situation that you should be able to, but for general season, you want archery to remain hard. That's kind of why you choose it, right? I mean, I've come back with a lot of tags, and you can boil them all you want, and they still taste the same. But that's the draw to archery for most people. If it wasn't for that, and you didn't keep some kind of tradition to the season, it would be hard. It's hard enough to hunt with a compound bow. So traditionalists that go out and hunt and kill with their bows, my hats are off to them. I find a hard enough time with a compound. So you wouldn't want to put it on a rifle platform for the average person to go out and do that. So another question for you is if you could go back and change anything that you want, and I guess it doesn't matter how far you can
Oh,
go back,
goodness, as
what would
far as
that be?
within our product line?
Yeah, sure. Or just in some decision that you made,
Yeah, I'm not
industry
sure I
based
would
at the
change
time.
very much. It's been a pretty fun ride getting to where we're at. There are, small little things about, product names and how we package and how we advertise things like that that we would change, but it's been pretty fun getting where we are now. I'm not sure if I'd be willing to risk changing anything. I might not get on a motorcycle with bear bait, but that's about it.
I figured that one might come up. Yeah. Well, and then I think maybe what you're pointing out on the name change is like your broadhead names, people aren't as familiar with them, but I'll tell you one thing about Brian before we finish is Brian, like he's got a titanium line, and in it I said I shoot the Van Dyke. That's after Larry Van Dyke. And then he's got a Del Maestro, which is the same ferrule but a different blade system. And his contr their contributions to making you who you are is that's kind of your payback to them, isn't it? I mean, that's how I see it. So people aren't going to be as familiar with that last name in a broadhead. But it certainly it shows what kind of character you have is you like to repay those people that helped you along the way, and that's what I see in these
Yeah, it's
Del
not just
Maestro and the
paying
Van
back,
Dyke.
but these are people that had heavy influence. Larry has been my hunting partner since the mid-80s, and is probably the best shot in the field that I've ever experienced. and he's been extraordinarily successful, and he's always like that small head. Everything's about accuracy with him. So when we were designing a new head for Dell, and Dell didn't want anything small, then we concentrated on that. He always liked silent, best flight. So Dell, on the other hand, he was more of a always been an East Coast hunter, even though he's traveled the world. International bow hunter Dell Del Mastro, who we lost last year to cancer, was always liked blood on the ground. He knew he wasn't very good blood trailer. It was very important that he had lots of blood on the ground. So he always wanted to have the largest head that he could get and still get to fly well. And so we went to the 3/16ths and decided that those concepts, which were different than my own concepts, sort of reflected the people that had the influence on us. And so that's why we have the Van Dyke and the Del Mastro.
Well, I just wanted to explain that to people that may not be familiar with that and why they have those particular names. And I know you've got the Phelps line too, which is has been really popular too in stainless steel, with the same type of design, of course, a little bit different ferrule,
Yeah,
but the
and we're
same
not
weight
working
system and
with Phelps
options that they
anymore.
have.
They have decided to go to a different head that they're representing. So it's really the rival series. Nothing's really changed in that, but the Phelps crew is now shooting. I think it's day six.
Okay, gotcha. So, but the broadhead design is the same. The only, it'll just have the name removed off the packaging in the future, but it'll just be
The
the rival.
entire what we call the Madman line, which are the new shorter blades type of broadheads, they really you've got the titanium series, the stainless steel series, a triple sec, which adds a one more locking system, and the Madman, and they're all basically the same head, but they feature the specific blades. You have the Van Dyke blade fits all of them, and the Del Mastro blade fits all of them. So it's really a person, depending on what materials and how you like your blades to lock into the ferrule, what are the different lines. But everything revolves around those two blades.
Yeah, that's what I like about it too, because it lets me play around with different ferrules that you have, and I can just change the collar out and put a different blade in, and I've got the same weight I want, and it's in a different ferrule with the same blade system that I like. So I've really liked that too. So Brian, I want to thank you for your time, and I want to wrap it up so that you can get back to your business and do everything. If you had one last question I want to ask you, if you had any advice for
For the pro
the pro
shops,
shops out there, what would it be?
I would say the biggest advice is never underestimate the value of service. And when, after we've been in business, I fight this myself. After we've been in business for a while, we tend to like to gravitate towards what's easiest for me. And we end up getting sort of run down, especially towards the end of the season. And it's like, well, we probably should do that, but that's not very easy for me. And we lose sight that the most important part of business is knowing who our customer is and what our customer's needs are. And so if you always put the most emphasis on service, I think you're always going to be successful.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. Henry, you got any last questions?
Nope, I think we're good there.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate your time, Brian, and we'll get this out and posted today, and hopefully it'll inform some other people getting into the business or get wanting to know what they should do for their setup and give them a little bit of advice as they move forward.
Okay, thank you,
So
Joe
again, we
Henry.
appreciate your time and thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks, Brian. And make sure to go look at his website. It's Radical Archery Design. And then if you guys got any questions for us or anything like that, you can follow us on Facebook or Instagram
Thank you.
or message us.